Thank you very much, Chris, for the invitation to be here, and to Dave for those insightful and challenging introductory comments. I'm interested to hear that not much has changed in 20 years. Actually, in the seat I'm sitting in, the odd thing has happened in the past 5 years, and I keep hoping for boredom. Not so far getting it. And you asked the question, should there be goals? Indeed, there should. And one of the things that I will touch on today is, in fact, that issue. The Payment System Board does think there should be some goals, and we'll have a bit more to say about that within a week or two of now. And the need for collaborative insights, as Chris said. Of course, the payment space is a space in which there are competitors, but there is also this need for collaboration and cooperation, particularly in the area of the underlying infrastructure underneath the payment system. And I want to say a couple of things about that. So it's an appropriate moment to talk about payments things, which I haven't done in public for a while. And it's doubly appropriate that we do so at this event, which marks 20 years of APCA, set up as a vehicle to coordinate decision-making in relation to clearing and settlement following a couple of prominent inquiries and reports back then. APCA, I understand, effectively replaced the Australian Clearing House Association, a body which was focused largely on checks. So how interesting, and how that actually has changed quite a bit, the prominence of checks relative to other payments devices over that time. The payments system, APCA, was established, as I say, 20 years ago, sharing the stage at that time with the Australian Payments System Council, which had been established earlier than that, as an advisory body to the government aimed at promoting and influencing the development of payment systems. APCA itself, of course, has evolved over the years. New clearing streams have been added, and APCA has moved into a role of industry representation. Its makeup has also evolved. I think it was originally chaired by a representative of the Reserve Bank, in fact, an arrangement that finished in 1998. So all of that change over an extended period is a sure sign that governance issues in the payment system are critical. And indeed, you can see that, in fact, all around the world. The institutional arrangements surrounding payments vary a bit around the world, but what doesn't vary very much is the nature of debate about governance matters, and I want to say a couple of things about that today. The other reason that it's appropriate to speak here today, of course, is, and many of you would know this, that the Reserve Bank Payment System Board has been undertaking a strategic review of innovation for the past year or so, and we're quite close now to releasing the conclusions of that review, probably within the next 1 to 2 weeks. I don't want to preempt those findings in detail today, but I do want to talk about some of the major themes just to arouse your interest. Naturally, most of you will be most interested in the implications of that for the payments industry, but there will, in fact, be implications for the Payment Systems Board as well, in particular in surrounding how we go about our work. And that's as it should be. The board is not a static entity. It also evolves with the times, and we certainly seek to do so. And so my focus today will be partly on that, partly on the role of the board. And in that regard, I want to talk briefly not just about payments innovation per se, but also the changing work of the board in the space of financial market infrastructure, in our attempts to preserve and maintain and increase financial stability, because that's taking up an increasing amount of our time. So why then all the focus on innovation and payments? Why is that important? You might think it's strange, actually, for the central bank to put as much attention on that issue as we have over the past year. After all, historically, Australia has, I think, reaped considerable dividends from allowing, in most cases, commercial imperatives to drive the process of delivering reform and new products, including payments products. We take perhaps some more cautious, somewhat more interventionist approach when we're thinking about risk in the financial system, as recent developments over recent years would make clear. But in general, the notion that a regulator might be involved in innovation per se might perhaps be seen as inconsistent with the overall thrust of regulatory approach in Australia historically. Certainly the Payment System Board has been reluctant to pick winners. And the other reason it might seem slightly anomalous for the RBA to be preoccupied with payments innovation is that we see actually quite a lot of it going on around us already. If you think about the rise of PayPal, the spread of chip, and now contactless cards, the amount of energy that's going into mobile payments technologies at this time, there's clearly no shortage of attempts at innovation at present. But there is a problem. And this is a problem about which I think many people in the payments industry have become more concerned themselves over time. And the problem is that the innovation in customer-facing technology is moving faster than the underlying infrastructure which supports all that technology. That's a problem because innovation in a network industry isn't the same as innovation in other industries. No matter how much time, effort, or money any particular entity itself puts into innovation and into changing the way that its customers interface with its own systems, the payment service that it can provide is only as good as the arrangements that allow payments to pass between financial institutions. Those arrangements are in the cooperative space. Not even the most innovative payments provider has the capacity to control all of those on its own. And so it's easy to see how that could potentially act as a constraint on innovation. Cooperative decision-making between competitors is, of course, notoriously difficult. The implications of different business mixes, strategies, and investment cycles can easily derail cooperation, not to mention the constraints of trying to make decisions in a committee-based structure. So these are classic coordination issues, which is a case where, on occasion, some external impetus might be required to help initiate change. Even if coordination problems could be overcome for an innovation that's in the public interest, institutions collectively might find it difficult to make a business case to invest. So once again, this is largely a quirk of the payments industry, where you have two-sided markets, where the market has to satisfy two distinct sets of customers, the merchants and the consumers, for example, typically in a card-based payment system. In two-sided markets, the price faced by each set of end users might be altered so that the party with the greatest decision-making power faces the lower price. That's most evident, of course, in credit card markets, where consumers typically face a low or even negative price, while merchants face a relatively high price. And the flow of interchange fees to support that has traditionally made issuing cards profitable for financial institutions. Because payment systems often don't operate simply on a user-pays model, establishing a business case for innovation can be more difficult than in other industries, even where there is clearly a demand from the end users. So that means there can be a case for some kind of mechanism to overcome these coordination problems and to ensure that, and this is important, any disconnect that might exist between the public interest and the business case is properly managed. So that is where the case for potential regulatory intervention comes from. That said, any intervention by a regulator like the Payment System Board of the Reserve Bank must, of course, be very carefully considered. We're going to be addressing this from two different perspectives. Firstly, we're going to say some things about governance arrangements within the industry, with the aim of giving those the best possible prospects of successful collective decision-making and appropriate consideration of the public interest. More details on that will be coming out in the conclusions of the review, which, as I say, you'll have within the next couple of weeks. Secondly, the board believes that in order to overcome coordination problems, it will need to take a stronger role in setting some general goals for the payment system over the years ahead, so as to help provide an appropriate focus for the innovation of all of you. There will need to be, in our view, a greater interaction between the board and the industry to establish and work towards those shared goals over time. Our assessment of experience both here and overseas is that superior industry outcomes have been achieved when there has been some policy influence in promoting public interest goals. Examples range from reform of the ATM system here in Australia to the establishment of the faster payment service for real-time payments in the UK. Therefore, you can expect the conclusions of the review to have more to say about a more constructive engagement between the board and the industry in relation to payments innovation. The board will not be picking winners, nor generally will it seek to dictate the technical details of payment system. We're a policy-making body. The technical details are actually your role, and we wouldn't seek to impose technical details unless we felt that, unless we were aware of a clear public policy basis for seeking to prefer one approach over another. So we won't be dictating technical details. It is for the board to provide guidance as to what outcomes we believe are appropriate and required in the public interest, but not specific solutions. That's clearly in your domain. It's in the domain of the industry experts. But it's important that those experts be informed by the broader policy goals that the Payment System Board thinks are appropriate. Our thinking about those goals has been informed by two general considerations during this innovation review process. Firstly, early on in the strategic review, we identified a number of attributes that were clearly valued by end users, as well as some that are important in payment system design. These included such things as the timeliness of payments, accessibility, ease of use, ease of integration into other processes such as business systems, and of course safety and reliability. Examining the services the payment system offers in terms of these attributes points to the areas where greater innovation in the payment system is needed and areas where underlying infrastructure might be imposing constraints on innovation at present. Secondly, the board has had an eye to developments in retail payment systems around the world, an understanding of what's available elsewhere and whether those things are valued and adopted by the users of payment systems is a very important common sense test considering when considering what our own system ought in some sense to look like in the future. This effort has been in part aided by the interactions with many of the parties, many of you, over the course of the strategic review, along with work done in the BIS Committee on Payment and Settlement Systems, which has recently conducted and published an examination of innovation in retail payment systems. On the basis of all that information, the board sees the need to focus on the infrastructure capabilities of retail payment systems more than on the specific retail products that are or could be on offer. Appropriate infrastructure, of course, can only be delivered cooperatively, but success in that delivery will allow payments providers to compete vigorously over the products and services that they offer to consumers. That should be true not just for deposit-taking institutions, as important as they are, but for other innovative players that have something to offer in the provision of retail payments. I talked before about customer-facing innovation outpacing innovation in the core infrastructure. What the board is interested in doing is trying to lift those constraints imposed by the infrastructure. As to the specific areas on which the board is focused, well, to those of you who've followed this process and the documents that have been produced along the way, it will be no secret that one of the areas that we've focused on is timing of payments. It's very clear that both individuals and businesses are demanding greater immediacy and greater accessibility in all facets of their day-to-day lives, and that includes payments. People expect to be able to book an airline ticket and choose their seat at any time of the day. They expect to be able to download a book or music while they're sitting on the bus. And our payment system supports those transactions by allowing the payment to be initiated and the goods and services exchanged, even though the funds won't be available to the merchant until sometime later. This delivers the immediacy to the transaction itself and the activity, and that's what people have come to expect. On the other hand, if a business or individual wishes to receive funds into an account at a financial institution, that same immediacy is not yet available. For instance, if a business wishes to make timely use of the proceeds from a large shipment, or an individual is in need of emergency assistance from a government agency, and that's been a very real issue in some recent episodes that we can all think of, then the options are much more limited. That's because the infrastructure that underpins retail payments assumes that making funds available the next business day is sufficient. Well, that's served acceptably well to date, but with real-time payments transfers available in countries ranging from the UK to Mexico, our approach is now starting to look a little dated. It's our belief that availability of real-time transfers would fill some important existing gaps, but would also open up enormous potential for innovation on top of that system. That would contrast with the current situation where a significant amount of effort is being put into finding workarounds for the current constraints in the system that we have. Another element of timeliness is the availability of payment systems outside of standard banking hours. Some systems, such as card payment systems, give the impression of operating 24/7, but in reality no funds move between financial institutions out of hours, and that constrains the services that can be offered to end users of the payment system. Now, you could argue that more than that isn't necessary yet, and that consumers and businesses are not yet unduly inconvenienced by this. That might have been a reasonable argument up to now, but we receive enough complaints in this area to suggest that expectations are changing. It's not that long ago that it was accepted that if a person wanted to ensure they had enough cash to see them through the weekend, well, they had to get to their bank before closing time on Friday afternoon. That's not that long ago. But none of us would accept today that would be appropriate. And I think we have reason to hold the rest of the payment system to the same standard. One question that we've come back to during the strategic review is what sort of payment system architecture would best allow us to deliver the features that we think might be demanded by payment system users in the years to come, including improved timeliness. Australia has had a long-running practice of operating payment systems that are based both on bilateral business arrangements between participants and bilateral exchange of payments between those huge participants. That model, although it's worked well for a long time, presents a number of problems, not least the complexity and cost of adding a new entrant, which must establish similar arrangements with each existing participant. Some of the significant changes we've seen in the payment system over the past few years have represented partial moves away from those bilateral arrangements. That includes the move to the industry community of interest network for clearing payments, and the creation of EFTPOS Payments Australia Limited to centralise governance of the EFTPOS system. These changes denote recognition of the constraints that bilateral systems put on us. Now, the Reserve Bank does not advocate just walking away from some of the well-established and low-cost bilateral systems that we have. But we can see a strong case for any new architecture that's established to meet emerging needs to be based on centralised architecture, that is, a hub-and-spokes sort of model. So they're some of the things that will gain attention when the conclusions of the strategic review come out within the next couple of weeks. I don't mean to suggest that having identified these issues, they'll be solved quickly, but I think we, that is the industry, you and us as the regulator, owe it to the users out there, whom we all serve, to embark now on a process that will get us onto a better path for the future. And that's what we're about. As a next step in the months ahead, following the release of the conclusions of the review, I hope there will be healthy dialogue between the bank and the industry on the sorts of goals that the Payment System Board has in mind, along with more focused discussion on the potential specific solutions. Now, I want in my remaining time to talk a little bit more widely about other things that the Payment System Board is doing. The reality is that our mandate of promoting stability, efficiency, and competition requires the board to play quite different roles to two different sorts of people out there, two different sorts of players. Now, most of you in this room would be thinking of the PSB as the body that capped credit charge interchange fees. I know one of our most popular decisions. And that worked with the payments industry to achieve change in the ATM system. But there's another set of players out there who think of the Payment System Board as the body that seeks to ensure the stability of key financial market infrastructure, FMIs as they're now known, such as security settlement systems and, increasingly importantly, central counterparties that stand between financial market participants in order better to manage risk in the system. Much of that role came to the board a little later than the initial retail payments efficiency role. In fact, came when the Corporations Act was changed in 2001 to adopt licensing arrangements for clearing and settlement facilities. And as important as the board's work on payment system efficiency is, the stable operation of FMIs has a direct bearing on financial market stability and financial system stability more broadly. Oversight of these FMIs is therefore demanding a significant and increasing proportion of the board's time. Now, in fulfilling that responsibility, the board is traditionally focused on the high-value payment system, RITS, that we own and operate, and many of you, of course, are familiar with that, along with the debt and equity settlement systems operated by the ASX and the central counterparties also operated by the ASX. We've for some years as well now been part of the oversight arrangement for continuous link settlements that does global foreign exchange settlement. But two developments mean that the banks and the board's workload in this area is increasing. Firstly, while most financial market infrastructure in Australia is currently operated by one entity, cross-border competition is increasing, particularly for central counterparty clearing services. So it's likely that the RBA's role in this area will increase and become more complex as it has to deal with new entities that seek to offer services in the Australian market. The other development affecting the board's role is the global push to strengthen financial regulation in the wake of the financial crisis. That includes the push for OTC derivatives to be cleared through central counterparties and reported to trade repositories as embodied in the G20 commitments made at Pittsburgh in 2009. All of that means that financial market activity that is important to Australia and Australians will increasingly be reliant on centralised financial market infrastructure. The logic of that reform, of course, is that it will reduce and simplify bilateral exposures between counterparties. But in so doing, it will increase the systemic importance of these centralised bits of infrastructure that we're setting up, because we are, in effect, creating a small number of so-called single points of failure. Hence, the resilience of that infrastructure will be critical, and the obligation of the official sector to provide proper oversight to ensure that resilience correspondingly will increase. These trends have been recognised in a number of areas that will affect the Payment System Board's work in the period ahead, and let me talk a little bit about that. Firstly, the international standards used by central banks and securities regulators around the world as the cornerstone for oversight of these FMIs have been comprehensively rewritten to reflect the lessons of the crisis and the increased importance of counterparties and trade repositories. The revised standards were released last month, and it will be a substantial task for us in the RBA to reflect those changes in our own regulatory framework over time. Secondly, the Council of Financial Regulators, the body that combines ourselves, the Treasury, ASIC and APRA, has made a number of recommendations regarding the framework for regulation of FMIs in Australia, including that the RBA, along with ASIC, be given the power in extremis to step in and operate an FMI in the event that it suffers some kind of persistent financial or operational problem. We've long had that capacity in the case of Austraclear because of the systemically important nature of that system for the operation of the domestic money market. And so probably that power is also needed in some of the other FMIs that may come into existence for an extreme situation. Domestic work in that area is occurring in parallel with international efforts to develop principles for the recovery and resolution of FMIs should that be needed. So over the coming year, we need to devote considerable time to working out how such arrangements would operate in Australia. And then thirdly, following further work by the Council of Financial Regulators, the Treasury is consulting on a legislative framework which could support mandating of central clearing, exchange trading or reporting of OTC derivatives transactions should that be warranted. Initially, our intention is not to mandate that, but to rely on existing market and regulatory incentives to promote central clearing, but the power to mandate would be there if needed. And the Payment System Board is likely to have a central role in any new regulatory regime there. So it's inevitable that the bank and the board will become increasingly involved with cooperative oversight arrangements for these financial market infrastructures, both at home and indeed around the world. So the financial stability element of the Payment System Board's mandate will only increase, I think, as we go into the future. That's a continuation of a trend that's already been underway for a while now, and we've already responded to that with a significant boost in the resources that we devote to such issues inside the bank. This work of the Payment System Board on the regulatory framework, of course, complements the RBA's broader focus on financial stability generally, which, of course, is overseen by the Reserve Bank Board, our other board. Let me then conclude. There's a clear sense within the Payment System Board that our work over the next few years will, in some respects, take us into some different activities. The work for which we've mostly been known has focused on addressing problems or distortions as we saw it in individual systems, albeit with the knowledge that those distortions had significant effects on other parts of the system. The solutions have tended to be focused on the rules of such systems. But payments innovation requires something quite different, because it's more clearly about solving coordination problems, which by their nature are likely to be ongoing and do not necessarily occur only within the confines of one existing system. Addressing that issue will require a change in the nature of the conversation between the board and the payments industry. And that conversation, of course, began with the Innovation Roundtable earlier this year. It will continue, I hope, in the period ahead, stimulated, I trust, by the release of the conclusions of the review. At the same time, the board's mandate in relation to financial stability remains, obviously, as it must, a key focus. And the global response to the crisis dictates that we take a greater, probably more complex, role as the global focus shifts to centralised financial market infrastructures. That doesn't mean we'll be paying less attention to the issues for which we're best known in the past. Much as we might like to live in a world where that sort of regulation isn't necessary, we don't live in that world, and those issues probably won't become any fewer or less complex. And we remain committed to meeting our legislative responsibilities in that area. Indeed, one challenge from innovation that may well occur is that old tensions about competition might emerge in new ways, and so we will need to remain vigilant to that possibility. So in conclusion, congratulations to APCA, 20th birthday. There is no doubt, as Dave said, an exciting time ahead in the payment space. I hope not quite so exciting in some other spaces. And hopefully the excitement will be for the right reasons, that the future is one of innovation, of efficiency, and, of course, of stability. Thank you for your attention.
Governor, thank you very much. A very interesting speech. We were on tenterhooks to
get... Could you identify yourself?
My name is... we were on tenterhooks to see whether we got any tidbits of information about the innovation review, and there are some tantalising glimpses there, which no doubt will emerge further. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the nature of the change conversation, if you like, with the Payment System Board. As a consultation body ourselves, APCA has struggled with the changing way you have to engage with your stakeholder base in the past. So set piece, consultation document, submissions in response and outcome is hard to maintain in a world where the ground's shifting all the time. Innovation is moving as you have the discussion, and any outcomes need to be worked on collaboratively over a period of time. Do you have any further views on the nature of that interaction? It's quite a challenging agenda.
It is challenging, Chris, and I think we ourselves kind of struggle a little with the same sorts of issues. I think the point I'd make is that obviously, the potential key stakeholders need to be part of the conversation, and we don't know, as you don't, who in 5 years' time all the stakeholders might be. So I guess we have to have an architecture for the conversation that allows some permeability, if you like, through the membrane there to kind of allow those interests and those views to come in. I think one of the things that you'll see in the review is that, in our opinion, the governance of whatever industry bodies you choose to establish, APCA obviously being one of the key ones at present, we think governance of those is very important, and we think that having an explicit recognition of the need for public policy considerations to be given their due weight and appropriately managed and balanced against the commercial imperatives is critical. The bank is very keen to see that, both from the industry and in our interactions with you, and there'll be a bit more about those sorts of things in the document when it comes out. So I think I'd nominate those things as key. But this is a complex conversation in an evolving space. We're conscious of that, and so we're keen to try to keep an architecture for all this that's open and not too much set in concrete. I think that's probably as good as I can do on that today.
Elena Wise from PayPal. One of the things that we're seeing in the industry is a blurring of the lines between online and offline, but also card present and card not present transactions. Traditionally in the credit card industry, the issuer's price for risk and the acquirer's price for risk based on card present and card not present, around fraud and risk and the like. Once we start to see the smartphones and mobile, we're already seeing that coming into the industry, and it becomes increasingly more difficult to understand which transaction is card present and which one is card not present. How are you thinking about the interchange regulations around that issue?
Well, I don't want to go into any detail about interchange today, and the issue of fraud, of course, is... That is another area where things are evolving, and to date I think probably the various players in Australia have managed that reasonably well, but it's a changing space, and as you say, there are new products on offer. To the extent there turn out to be any implications for interchange from that, it's not obvious whether there is or not, but if there is, well... There's a process of discussion that we have with the relevant players on that could take that up, I'm sure. But I don't want to foreshadow that today.
Can I ask one slight addition to that question, if you don't mind? One of the areas that I'm sure you're watching avidly is the evolution of mobile as a new payments channel. One of the changes in Europe is the introduction of payments legislation, which means that mobile operators, for example, can take areas of less systemic risk, small value payments, for example, and run them themselves without having to do it in partnership with a bank. Could you imagine, you know, some changes like that in this?
Well, the role of telecoms providers is, you know, that's obviously going to be quite material in all this as we move ahead, and I think that they'll end up being part of the conversation, but I don't have any particular strategy on that to foreshadow today. I think that's part of the ongoing conversation that we'll need to have.
I'm Leslie Martin, and I guess my best affiliation at the moment is FPOS Payments Australia Limited. I've actually got a question about regulation and what we're seeing across the world with the implementation of Basel III and some of the excited interventions in places like the US with Dodd-Frank. Do you have a view on which jurisdiction is handling these kinds of things best?
Us, of course.
I may be biased, but I might even agree.
Well, there is, as you say, I'm not sure excited would be the term I'd use, as one who's on a body called the Financial Stability Board that's trying to kind of keep tabs on everything that's going on, and that's an almost impossible task. But there's certainly a very robust set of regulatory interventions underway across a number of jurisdictions. And I think one can understand why that's happening. You know, if your taxpayers have had to put their hand in their pocket to help banks, even though in the US case that's probably been at a profit, actually, for the US taxpayer, at least for the banks. But if in the US or the UK or some other countries in Europe and the taxpayers had to do that, you know, there's an understandable push, I think, to try to strengthen things so that that doesn't recur. I guess the difficulty is that many of these regulatory interventions, we're doing a lot in a very short time. You know, I literally have lost count of how many subgroups there are in the FSB world. We need to take care that things are carefully designed so as not to run too high a risk of unintended consequences. There always are unintended consequences of regulatory interventions. That's the nature of the beast. But, you know, a fair bit of care is needed there. And, you know, Dodd-Frank is an area where there are many complexities, and the ultimately, in all these things, implementation is ultimately going to be critical, really. Whether it's Dodd-Frank, Basel, the various corresponding things under the care of some of the other standard-setting bodies, central clearing, you know, there are many complexities there, particularly for countries like us that are small jurisdictions. So that is the world we live in. And I think there's no choice but to try to have some regulatory reform, really. It was never going to be feasible to say, let's not change anything. But a lot of care needs to be taken in implementation, really, without giving you a longer sermon. I think thus far, in Australia's case, we're probably striking about the right balance.
Hi, I'm Kate McKenzie from the Financial Times. Sorry, this question is completely off the topic from payments. I'm just wondering, I imagine obviously the RBA looks pretty closely at the Chinese data. The last few weeks we've seen some really interesting conflicting signals coming out, conflicting particularly with the official data, had very low loan growth in April and so far in May, and also very low unofficial PMIs and electricity output data. I'm just curious if you can give us a sense of whether the RBA is starting to maybe shift in the way that you are, you know, assessing the data coming out of China. These divergences are really widening.
I think it's true that there have been some data in China of a materially slower nature in recent times. It's always hard to know, of course, to what extent that's a persistent phenomenon as opposed to temporary. In the case of the PMIs, they're soft, though. One caution I would offer is we typically read that because it's below 50, that means they're contracting. Actually, what it means is they're growing slower than average, I think, really, if you calibrate that carefully. But there's no doubt the data in China in the past month or 6 weeks have been on the softer side, and that's probably partly a flow-on of weaker demand out of Europe, and it's probably partly a reflection of the fact that they've engendered a slowdown in order to get on top of some of the problems they had in the property sector. So all we can do is watch that and try to assess it as time goes by, but I don't really want to deliver a lengthy assessment of China or indeed any other country here today. It's an issue to watch.